Hello and welcome to episode 72 of A Little Bird Told Me, the podcast where two freelance writers tell you all the tricks of the trade. We are here to save you from mighty embarrassment and mortifying mistakes and guide you to the very top of your chosen profession. Freelancing is a funny old world and we want to help you along the way. Tune into the podcast every 2 weeks. And if you go to alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com, you can subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. So, whether iTunes, an RSS podcatcher, or Stitcher Smart Radio are your platform of choice, we've made it really easy to sign up and be the first to hear our latest words of wisdom. On that site, you'll also find any links we mention and links to our own websites and social media feeds, as well as the A Little Bird Told Me Facebook page too. I am Philippa Willits.
And I am Laurie Hartson. And this week we are going to be looking at some relatively quick and or easy ways to boost your freelance income. Now, business development when you're a freelancer can feel like a bit of a slog sometimes, in fact most of the time. So it's nice to have irons and a few fires just going on while you're doing your usual work. Now, while these suggestions that we're coming up with today aren't necessarily passive income and residual income streams in the traditional sense of the terms, what we wanted to do is look at a few ways to give your inbound queries a bit of a pick-me-up without adding loads of extra work to your plate, because, of course, we could say, do more work, do more expensive projects. But when you feel like you've got a full plate anyway, but you're still not quite making enough, or you'd like to earn a bit more, or you'd like to build yourself a safety net, these are the kinds of ideas that we're going to be looking at today. And because a lot of these streams can be set up and maintained when you've got a spare 15, 20 minutes here and there, they are a good choice for freelancers who are struggling to get started and are looking for some quick action. Because I hear this a lot from freelancers who are just getting into the swing of things, like, I'm doing stuff, but it's just not quite happening enough yet. So these are kinds of things that you can tackle to get started and then forget about.
Definitely, and also because of the kind of come-and-go nature of a lot of freelancing work, you will have times when the money's rolling in and times when it seems to go dry. So having some backup, passive or residual income can really help you out on those occasions. Plus, you know, there'll be situations where you might get ill or you might want to take a holiday, and it's nice to have a bit of extra coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the big things that understandably makes people hesitate about going freelance. It's the potential lack of stability and the lack of a regular income. And I say understandably because it is. If you're a freelancer, you don't have the regular salary and you don't have maternity pay or sick pay or holiday pay. So, you know, these kinds of passive income streams and residual income streams and low maintenance income streams are a very good thing for taking on some of that strain, especially if they can look after themselves most of the time. So it is well worth considering what you can do alongside your everyday work activities just to create that little financial safety net or a little bit of a financial boost for yourself. So these additional income streams don't necessarily have to be writing work, is the first thing that I'm going to say. You might be thinking, but I write all day, every day. And I do creative writing, and I find that not as a residual income stream, but just as a hobby. And so, you know, I do get that thing of I've written all day, and now I'm just going to sit down and write something creative and wonderful and lovely. And it can feel overwhelming sometimes. You might find that carrying out content writing work all day is just enough, and you fancy doing something a little bit different. Alternatively, you might go the other way and think, well, writing's what I do. You know, I don't mind doing writing all day, so I'll stick with what I'm good at. And it's up to you entirely, but you can consider all kinds of things, so don't limit yourself. Have a good think about your skills, your hobbies, your pastimes, and try and come up with something that fits in with your life and your interests.
In many of the ideas we suggest, your writing skills will certainly come in handy.
Absolutely. I mean, we do have to live up to the whole freelance writing podcast thing, so we're not going to go too far off piste.
That's it. So don't forget, in whatever additional projects you might decide to take on, you do know how to write persuasively or informatively or chattily or whatever it is you need. Mm-hmm. Another point to make at this stage is that this single episode is not enough to tell you how to do all the things we're going to suggest.
True, and we probably don't know how to do them all.
What is true, though, is that the internet is full of detailed advice. So if we discuss an idea that you love the sound of, find some reputable sources online for step-by-step how-to guides.
Absolutely. And you can always come and have a chat with us and the other freelance writers at our Facebook page, and that's at facebook.com/freelancewritingpodcast. There are lots of lovely people on there, and they're getting a little bit less quiet now, which is great.
We love it.
We love it. So do feel free with any questions or discussions.
And so, without further ado, we're going to start looking at some of the additional income streams that you can get as a freelance writer.
Yeah, the first thing that I'm going to suggest is something called hourlies, and that's on peopleperhour.com. Now, People Per Hour, like many freelancing sites, is mostly for people bidding on jobs. Clients, potential clients, go on there, post a job that they need doing. Let's say they need, they need a fence painting or they need a blog post writing. And then freelancers will come along and bid on that. Sometimes the client will put in place a suggested price, sometimes they won't. And like any freelancing website, it can be quite brutal. It can be a little bit Hunger Games.
I think it's slightly better than some of the others, but not always, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, the prices tend to start a little bit higher.
Yeah.
Per hour. I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's because it's a UK site. I don't know if it is a UK site, but it feels that way.
Yeah.
It's international, certainly, but for whatever reason, as Pip says rightly, prices are a little bit higher and it's a little bit less brutal. But like anything, you know, it's getting that way more.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've spoken to freelancers in the past who said, I just can't be doing with that. I can't be doing having to search for things and just apply for things, because it's very much a numbers game if you act that way.
Yeah.
You know, if you source work that way and you're chasing projects that come up, you have to be on the go and ready to respond, and
yeah,
you have to tailor your response. So it can be very stressful, particularly as, with it being a numbers game, you're not going to get most of the work that you apply for.
Yeah, it's that's the kind of work for me that I, yeah, no, I can never be bothered, really, because, like you say, if you put together a really detailed proposal,
and you have to, don't you?
Yeah, then you're going to spend a lot of time doing that, and you're going to get very little of the work because of the numbers of people applying, and because a lot of people will make a judgment on price regardless of the rest of the proposal.
Well, this is a good point as well. You know, even if you do get the work, you are going to have to be very competitive on price.
Yeah.
Because I think I said it in a previous episode, we're all human. You know, you go on a website like this looking for somebody to fulfill a project for you.
Mm.
And it's hard to opt for a more expensive person. It's counterintuitive.
Yeah,
particularly
yeah.
When you see other people, you know, maybe you don't understand freelance writing so much if you're a client, and you see other people saying, well, I'll do it for £5, and then someone else is saying, well, I'll do it for £30.
Yeah.
It's very hard to know why you should opt for that £30 person.
Yeah, yeah.
So back to People Per Hour, hourlies then. What these are set fee projects that you can set up on your own profile. So if you go on People Per Hour and you set yourself up a profile as a freelance writer, you can establish these hourlies, which, for example, if you were me and Pip, there might be, say, a 500-word SEO blog post for X pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, if somebody sees your profile and you optimize your profile nicely with lots of information and keywords and things like that, if people see that and they think, right, well, you know, X pounds sounds good to me, I like the look of this person, they have to buy that from you before you start the work.
And it's the parameters are set.
Yes.
You know exactly what you're getting, you know exactly what you're offering.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything. You can set up an hourly and you can leave it.
Yeah.
You know, people may come and buy, they may not come and buy, but you're there, there's no debate, there's no discussion, there isn't a negotiation stage.
Yeah.
And if the client wants to buy that piece of work from you, the money has to go into an escrow account.
Yeah.
They have to pay up before the thing happens. And of course, you know, they could dispute at the end, you know, But then you would get the people per hour, customer service people getting involved. Generally, you don't get ripped off if you're providing somebody with an hourly, as long as you fulfill the job that you said you were going to fulfill within the time frame that you said you were going to fulfill it in.
I know you have a lot more people per hour experience than I do, because I know you've hired various people from there before, whereas I've used it a couple of times, and both times I've bought an hourly. The first was that guide to migrate two of my websites.
Uh-huh.
That was a people per hour hourly, so he knew exact, you know, he had a set fee for migrating a website from one host to another. Yep. And so I bought two of his hourlies, gave him all the information he needed for my two websites, and he did it. And there's also a time limit as well.
Yeah.
So you set your own time limit when you set up the hourly. So one of the things I liked about this guy was that he promised to do it within 24 hours.
That's really good.
Whereas if, it's, say, you're offering a big, you know, I will write an e-book for you, and that's a big project, you would put a longer time limit. But I like that kind of clarity on both sides, really.
Definitely.
Buyer and the seller is very clear about what's being offered.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that you just brought up, actually, is it's a point worth making. Just because it's called an hourly doesn't mean you need to do it in an hour. And it doesn't mean that it needs to be a task that could be fulfilled within an hour.
Yeah.
You could put a £500 project on there and say, my hourly for £500, I'll build you a website.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, it's just a set fee project.
The name hourly has always bugged me.
But yeah, no, I like hourlies because you can set them up and just leave them. And then if you get people coming along and saying, yes, I'd like to buy that, then great. You know, you get an email to your inbox. You don't even need to go on people per hour to keep checking your hourlies and see if anybody's interested.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to have on there. It's a good inbound marketing technique, I think.
Yeah.
And you can also, you can embed graphics on your website. So saying in the sidebar of your website, you can have a little button that says, buy a press release from me now for X pounds.
And if I remember rightly, then if somebody buys through your link like that, then people per hour don't take their commission.
They don't take commission if it's external link.
So you get the full amount as well, which is nice. And so that's one option. Another option is affiliate websites. Now, these aren't as easy as they were perhaps a few years ago. Affiliate websites now have to be a lot better than they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
There was...
Thank goodness, frankly.
Well, yeah. There was a time when somebody could throw up a 5-page website about fridges, add some Amazon affiliate links or AdSense ad code and cash in. But no more. Google is the big decider these days, and after their Panda and Penguin updates in particular, affiliate sites need to be bigger, they need to be well put together, and they need to be well maintained.
Yeah.
However, that's not to say it can't be done. I have a few, and they do okay. I'm never going to retire on their income.
Good.
But considering this is work I did several years ago and have barely looked at since, it's nice to get the odd check in the post as a result, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll interject here in case people don't know what an affiliate website is.
Yes, good point.
Now, an affiliate website is a website where you sell a product that has an affiliate program. And what that means is that somebody else will have developed a product. Sometimes it's software, sometimes it's an ebook, sometimes it's something else, something tangible. And what you can do is you can set up a website singing the praises of this project and trying to encourage people to buy it. Now, you use what's called an affiliate link. And if people click and they buy the product through that link, you get a commission on the product.
Yes.
Now, the commissions on products can be very, very generous, particularly if they're not very exciting products.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at sort of 60, 70% commission on some of, say, the big financial trading products, for example, financial trading bots, financial trading software, because they're hard to sell. So this is something for writers who really love getting down and dirty with sales copy. You have to be persuasive and salesy and informative, and you have to take an angle when you're writing content for an affiliate website. thinking, how am I going to persuade people to buy this? And it's not always a question of, come and have a look at product X. It's amazing. You want to buy it. Now, as Pip's pointed out, really good content is super important to Google. And things like how-to lists, things like, informative advertorials. People want more value from their content. They're not going to be persuaded by just a little bit of sales speak anymore. You can't just stick an ad up on a website and expect it to make money. You have to give people worthwhile content. And as Pip's already said, it's affiliate websites now. Do you tend to need a bit more maintenance?
For most people, if you're thinking of setting up an affiliate website, first of all, you need to fill it with great content. Think about, say you want to make money using Amazon affiliates around a particular product.
Mm-hmm.
You need to create a decent website all about that product that mostly isn't salesy, but that does it right.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, starting with Amazon or AdSense is the best place to start.
Yeah.
With AdSense, it's a bit different. You don't get commission when somebody buys something. You get commission when somebody clicks on an ad on your site. So they don't have to go on to buy. All they have to do is click.
Mm-hmm.
Often people then move on to sites like ClickBank,
yeah,
which sells big money products. And these often have 50%, 75%, or even 100% commission. So one sale via ClickBank can be worth several hundred AdSense clicks or dozens of Amazon purchases. Other places to consider are eJunkie, Commission Junction, Affiliate Window. There are loads of them.
Yeah.
We'll link to all of those in the show notes. But there are a lot of options.
Yeah, it's well worth having a look, because if you can find something and you think, actually, I know loads about that really obscure product or service, I could definitely write about that in an informative way. If Google doesn't have much content on there at the moment about, come on, Pip, think of an obscure product for me. Singing fridges. Fridges that sing when you open them. I'm not sure they exist. They probably do because internet. But singing fridges. So if you're an expert on singing fridges and you realize there's not much content on Google, that's going to make you more searchable. So if people are searching for singing fridges and they can't find information about these singing fridges on Google, and you come up with a gorgeous website and write all about them and then pop your commission links on there, then you're going to do quite well.
Yeah. And if you like the idea of building a website around a single product, like those on eJunkie or ClickBank, another opportunity would be to use all your best content writing skills to create your own product.
Mm-hmm.
You can build the similarly, very authoritative site like you would with an affiliate product. And you can use your best sales copy skills to promote the product. But it's your product, and so you've got ultimate control over what happens. You can even recruit your own affiliates who can then create websites all based around selling your product for you.
Yeah.
And unlike selling other people's stuff, you decide the price, you decide how it's presented, you can make sure that it's great quality as well, which isn't always guaranteed with certainly ClickBank products. So if you want to look at affiliate websites or at creating your own product, think about, as Laurie suggested, what you already know about. And from there, do some keyword research and some market research to work out precisely what angle to take.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps you're brilliant at gardening. So find out exactly what people want to know and create an ebook or a membership site or an online course about how to grow petunias or how to stop killing your roses or whatever other information people are looking for.
Absolutely. And you can twist it round slightly and create, I suppose, what you'd call a database site, really, couldn't you? If you can write about, say, how to grow petunias, you might find that you could interest garden centres and petunia specialists in having some space on your website and having their details on there. So if you've written a brilliant piece of informative copy about these petunias and about all these gardening things, think outside the box, to use a cliche. You know, you can't you know, you, it's not just that you can attract people who want to buy your product or who want to buy a membership to your tutorials or your ebook. You know, you can also attract people from the other side as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the third option that we're going to look at is selling ad space on your website or blog. Now, this you have to be a little bit careful about, because with affiliate websites, they're generally anonymous-ish. I mean, your details have to be on there somewhere. But it's not a question of it interfering with your brand, because generally your affiliate website will have nothing to do with your business, your freelance writing business. If you're going to be selling ad space on your website or blog, then you need to be careful about whom you sell the ad space to, because you don't want to end up damaging your own brand by having somebody spammy on there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a professional website, as in a work website, freelance writing business website, that gets decent traffic, and you understand traffic, and you know how to leverage traffic, then it's also an option to sell that traffic to somebody else. So you can give people static ad space. You could have, I don't know, you could have a header bar or a footer bar or sidebar advertising spaces, and you could sell those or offer those at different prices. Alternatively, what some prolific bloggers do, and some not so prolific bloggers actually, I've seen this work for people who have medium traffic websites, is to sell reviews or advertorials. Now, they make it clear, usually by something branded on their own website, like, I don't know, like paid post with a little picture, that they're getting money for this and that this isn't a completely disinterested blog post that you're reading. But a lot of the time, people, like indie authors, will sometimes pay bloggers to give an honest review of their latest book. Now, that could be something you could do.
Yeah, I was just going to say that are legal issues. If you're being paid for something, you have to disclose it legally.
Yeah. So, I mean, you see people, and they make it quite attractive, don't they? They'll come up with a little slogan or a little title, and then have a link to a page from that picture or from that title that takes you to a page to say, full disclosure, this, I've been paid for this, or this product was sent to me for free.
Yeah.
This was a sample product. I know mummy bloggers do it a lot, don't they?
Yes, and it's fashion bloggers as well.
Yes, and you know, you get fashion houses or baby product companies sending sample products, just as you do with people sending review copies of books to bloggers and saying, I'd really appreciate an honest review. Sometimes it's just in return for the product, sometimes there's some pay on top of that.
Now, if you're considering selling ad space on especially your professional website, you have to think very carefully about it, because on the one hand, as Laurie said, it is some income, and, you know, depending on your traffic, if you're getting in the tens of thousands a week, you could probably get some decent income from it. But the point of your website is to help people, help persuade people to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And once people are on your website, you have to be really careful about actively encouraging them to leave it.
True.
Which is what you're doing if you put ads on there.
True.
And so it could be a goose that lays the golden egg situation, where you might get 50 quid for an ad, but then lose 500 quid's worth of business because the client that came onto your website got distracted by your sidebar ad and went off elsewhere.
It's so well written as an advert that help pinging off your site. I would say, and it doesn't fully mitigate the situation, become a master of putting in hyperlinks that open links in new tabs. You know, there's an option certainly with WordPress when you insert a hyperlink, and you can just do it with the HTML coding as well.
Yeah.
Where you insert just a little tiny bit of extra code, or you click on a button if you're on the sort of non-HTML interface where it says open link in new tab. So that opens a new tab on the browser that the person is using, and it also keeps them on your website. So they're not just pinging off to go and have a look at your advertising instead of your website, as Pip's quite rightly pointed out.
Now, another option to consider is a website called Constant Content. And it's a freelance writing website, but it's quite different from the vast majority of others in that clients or customers can request articles, but the majority of what fills up Constant Content is it's writers writing about anything and everything they want and adding it to the site, and then buyers can come, search through the site, find the article they want and buy it.
It's a bit like hourlies in that sense.
Yeah, but you're doing the work up front.
You do the work up front, which is why I have a love-hate relationship with Constant Content.
Indeed, as do many people, because you could be working and never sell your piece.
Yeah.
One of the positives about Constant Content is that you not only set your own prices, but that they encourage fairly high pricing strategies.
Yeah, they do have a minimum, don't they?
They have a minimum, and they take quite a cut, but that's because they edit things very, very, very carefully. And so, yeah, they edit very scrupulously, but it means that the buyers come to know that the quality on the site is very good. They're not going to buy stuff that's full of mistakes like they might from other freelancing sites. But the thing, I think there's a way to use Constant Content that helps with the fact that you're doing spec work, essentially.
I know which point you're going to make, and I completely agree, for the record.
Thank you very much. and that's it. There are people who are pretty much full-time Constant Content writers, and for me, that wouldn't suit me, to write that much on spec. Although, obviously, they write a lot and therefore sell a lot. So it works. It works for some people. But for me, the most efficient way I find to write for Constant Content is if I've done a lot of research for a paid project. Say, I'll give an example from a few years ago so that it's not kind of sensitive. I was hired to write an entire website about a particular health issue. Man boobs. And so I had done all sorts of research about this. And so I'd written the pages of the website that the client wanted. So, like, what causes man boobs, how to get rid of man boobs. But in the process of the research, I learnt a lot more than what was needed for that website.
You're like a man boobologist, aren't you?
Yes, yes. And so I knew by the end of that piece of work that I also had plenty of information about alternative remedies for man boobs and how to prevent man boobs rather than get rid of them and that kind of thing. And that, so I didn't need to do extra research. My brain already knew these things.
Yeah.
And so then it wasn't too much extra work to knock out a few more articles and submit those to Constant Content. Similarly, there are things, like we mentioned earlier, if you know a lot about petunias or roses or anything that you just are interested in your daily life.
Yeah.
That's a great way of finding kind of sources for things to write about, but without adding tons of work in case this work doesn't sell.
And monetizing that extra info, because I hear this from people a lot, where they, you know, I heard it recently, in fact, again, people complaining and saying, I've done hours and hours and hours of research for this piece of work.
Yeah.
And they only needed 1,000 words, and I've got all this extra info, all these notes. What can you do with it? And if you have that stuff.
Exactly.
And there's something that you, Pip, came up with that I'd not really considered before, that I thought was brilliant. And I can't remember if you called it this or whether I just kind of labelled it as this in my head. It's like mirror imaging an article, like flipping an article.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you want to explain what it was?
No, go ahead.
I'd never thought of it before. But let me try and think of an example. If you'd written about, well, we'll use the man boobs as an example then, but this isn't something that Pip did, this is just a theoretical example. But if you've written about 6 ways to prevent getting man boobs, what you could do is sort of come up with an article about 5 ways, or 5 things that risk inducing, I suppose, man boobs.
Yeah.
It's not the best example, but if you flip the information, if you've written about how you get man boobs, then maybe you can write about how you prevent man boobs, or things that you shouldn't do, or yeah. else you risk getting man boobs.
Yeah.
You know, you can reframe so that the content is entirely original.
Yeah.
Doesn't risk reducing the quality or the value of the work that you've produced for somebody else, or clashing with that in any way,
yeah.
or plagiarizing, self-plagiarizing that work. It's entirely original, and yet it's just using the same information. You don't even need to have done more research.
Yeah.
You can simply utilize the research you've done in a different way and reframe that.
Definitely, because there are ethical issues around just recreating a piece of work that you've already yeah. done for somebody who's paid. And so, as Laurie says, that mirror imaging idea, or just, identifying themes that,
yeah.
that you've studied but that you didn't need to write for the other person. Yeah. And you then submit it, and like with a lot of the things we're suggesting, you can then forget about it. And then periodically you get a lovely email from
somebody. You often do forget, don't you?
Yeah.
Get an email going, oh, hooray, just got to check.
Yeah, that's it. You get an email from Constant Content saying one of your articles has sold. You go, yay. And because they encourage decent pricing, and because I often write very long things, which elicit higher prices, I'll then get an email and I've suddenly got 100 quid that I hadn't, you know, expected, or 150 quid, or if it's a short, you know, if it's a quick thing, even just the odd 40 quid.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's always a nice surprise when it happens.
Didn't it happen to you recently before you went on holiday?
Yeah.
You suddenly got some incoming work. And it's like, oh, bonus holiday pay.
Paid for my holiday. Thank you very much.
Hey, free holes. Lovely. Can't complain. So yeah, if you've got the ideas there and you've got a quick typing pace, I would say go for Constant Content. I'm personally not a fan because I spend a lot of my free time doing creative writing anyway. So the idea of writing all day, then doing creative writing, and then writing more articles, it's too much for me.
That's it. And, all the things we're talking about, some of them you'll think, what, you want me to create a whole website? A
whole ebook?
About fridges? What are you talking about? Whereas other people will go, that sounds perfect. And that's,
do that in half a day.
Exactly. And so all the ideas we're suggesting, really, are...
It's just whatever takes your fancy, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. Now, our next idea is one that does involve more work up front, but has potentially much higher returns, and not just financial ones. Platforms like Kindle, Lulu, CreateSpace have made publishing your own book easy and accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas self-publishing used to have an exclusively bad reputation, there is now enough good quality stuff that it's considered to be worthwhile enough that The Guardian have now announced they're going to have a self-published book prize.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so it's starting to be taken seriously. There is still a load of rubbish that's self-published, but frankly, there's a load of rubbish that's traditionally published.
Yeah, true.
And so I think its reputation is improving anyway. Now, you'd have to put a lot of work in at the start into the book, followed by work marketing it, but that could lead to years of royalty payments.
And
it can also give you other benefits as well. Some people describe writing a book as the best kind of business card you can have, and there's some truth in that. People are instantly impressed. They get an impression of you as somebody who really knows what they're talking about, and this is invaluable when you're freelancing and it's all about, you know, convincing people you can do what you say you do.
Yeah, it's extra clout, isn't it?
So if you have a specialist subject or a particular interest, do some research and see if there's a book in it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's such a personal achievement as well, isn't it? A lot of people are very, very pleased to have written a book.
Of course.
You know, of course, I've never written a full-length book simply because I've not got the patience for it. I tend to stick with short fiction.
Yeah.
But no, writing a book can be wonderful. And the same goes for membership sites or series of tutorials, series of blog posts.
Yeah.
Webinars, actually, if we're going to sort of branch out a little bit away from the writing. You know, online lectures, tutorials, teaching people how to do things.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a specialist subject, it's worth, because of course if you were going to come up with a series of tutorials, you'd have to put in a lot of research and effectively make lesson plans, and then usually you've got to give people some backup material. So you might end up actually writing something the size of an ebook to give to people as additional materials if you're featuring them with something. But if you have really in-depth knowledge, as a lot of freelance writers do, you know, they'll come from like science backgrounds and then get predominantly into science writing. You know, so you could write an ebook on how to do science writing, how to write about science, how to become a medical writer. Because there are the plenty things that you will be able to write about that others perhaps won't. You've just got to have a little bit of a think about what kind of saleable knowledge you have.
Yeah.
So the next type of additional income stream that we're going to have a look at is something that we've touched on already with the affiliate marketing, but it's something that I have a little bit more experience in, and that's leveraged income. Now, leveraged income is making money on other people's products and services, and it can sound quite mercenary, but at the end of the day, it's how pretty much all business is done.
Yeah.
I, for example, write for a number of clients who are agencies, as a lot of freelance writers do. Now, what those agencies will do is they will have clients. They will pay me a certain fee for my writing work, and then they will charge their clients more.
Yes, I have the same.
Yeah. So you can do the same. There's no reason that you can't operate as a freelancer in an agency kind of way. If you can find a decent service or product available for a reasonable, and I mean reasonable for both you and the supplier, for a reasonable price, and you can find a market for that product or service, there's nothing to stop you selling it on.
Yeah. And so as we've talked about before, kind of possibly teaming up with people whose work complements that of a freelance writer. I always have to say it like that. I know. And so it may be that if you're working with a client who wants a new, while you're providing their website content, they actually want a new website design as well. If you decide you want to take responsibility for liaising between the two, it's not a matter of no work. This can end up being a right thorn in your side if you're not careful. Yeah. But if you decided to take this approach, what you could do, rather than saying, my mate Sarah designs really good websites, you could say, I can sort that out with you. I work with a very good designer. And then you can be the go-between.
Yeah.
Rather than Sarah billing your client, Sarah bills you. And then you bill your client for that little bit more. You get some extra money out of it, but it's not as simple, is it, as just kind of, say, maybe the equivalent of an affiliate site where you just leave it to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do this with writing work, and I do it with other kinds of work.
Yeah.
And you have to, as Pip's quite rightly pointed out, she's done quite well to point this out because it's a very pertinent point. You have to take responsibility if you are delivering a service.
Yeah.
All your client knows is that that service is being fulfilled and that you are taking responsibility for it. So if, for example, my agency clients were to say to their clients, here's the website content, and it was no good, I'd written a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
It would not be on my head, it would be on theirs.
Yeah.
And the same, you know, I hire people to write blog posts for me. When I get those blog posts back, I have to proofread them. I have to edit them. I have to format them. I provide images to go with them. I make sure that the SEO is up to scratch. I feed back to the writers if there's an error, if there's a problem, if it's just not quite up to scratch. So I do get to charge more. But you have to pay your suppliers a decent amount anyway. Yeah. So as Pip's quite rightly pointed out, it's not a question of, ha ha ha, I will just stick a markup on this and then do the work. Because that's when you get bitten on the bum. If you send a piece of work over that you haven't checked, it is sod's law that there will be a massive typo in the middle of it, or there'll be something ridiculous, and you have nobody to blame but yourself. And you cannot say, oh, well, it wasn't me that wrote it.
And the thing, like, Laurie does this, as she said, you know, a fair amount during her work, and she handles it really well.
Oh, thank you.
You do. With, I have done it on a very small scale with just kind of overflow work, really.
Yeah.
And I find it incredibly stressful. I think because...
It's a risk, isn't it?
It is, and I'm relying on somebody else to do something that I'm taking ultimate responsibility for. So if they don't meet their deadline, will I meet mine? If they send me something that's utterly awful...
It happens a lot.
Yeah, and that degree of relying on somebody else stresses me out.
You have to know your own... And this isn't aimed at you, this is for the listeners. You have to know your own processes.
Yeah.
So as Pip's again rightly pointed out, deadlines are the major risk with this. So if I send it, you have to be organised. You have to send over a piece of work with as much time to spare as you possibly can, and know that if it all goes to pot, that you have to find a solution for that, because otherwise you can end up losing a client. The number of times, and this has happened to my agency clients as well, when they've been looking for people, they'll outsource a piece of work and then they'll be expecting it back on the Friday, schoolboy error, and it will come, you know, due back to their client on the Monday, and they'll get a load of rubbish on the Friday night, or they just won't get anything.
Yeah.
So that leaves them, or in fact me, covering the piece of work over the weekend in time for Monday morning. And if you outsource it because you don't have time to do the work, this can be a nightmare and it can lead to no sleep. But that's your call. You know, you
that's
have to
opt and
no sleep rather than letting your client down.
And for me, although, you know, overflow work, I'm always going to need it at some point.
Yeah.
But I think this way of working, while it suits Laurie really well, I just get so stressed that I just may as well have done it myself in most cases. Yeah. And so I think there's a personality thing. I'm a bit of a control freak. But if you can make it work, which Laurie does and which a lot of people do, and you're happy to take that responsibility and realise it's not as simple as just getting a 20 quid cut on the top of every piece of work, you know, it does involve extra work. It can be a really good way to grow your business, kind of almost exponentially, really, if you can get it right.
And it starts off organically, or at least it did for me. You know, it wasn't a conscious decision. As Pip's pointed out, as with Pip's experience, I started outsourcing work when one of my clients just needed too much from me.
Mm.
I could not fulfill, I think they needed about 40 blog posts a week.
Yeah.
And there's no way I could fulfill that. So finding somebody decent to help me with that work was very, very difficult. You've got to go through kissing a lot of frogs.
Oh, you do.
So many frogs. So many. And they're really froggy frogs as well. Fucking awful frogs. No, they're dreadful. You've got to kiss a lot of frogs. And sometimes it does cost you some money because you have to pay people for test pieces of work and things like that. And you have to find somebody suitable. But then when that person's on, you have to brief that person. You have to send them the information that they need, proofread their work, edit their work, feed back to them, manage them, decide what you're going to do if they go on holiday or if they can't do the work anymore.
Mm.
There are so many things to consider. So
I was talking to someone the other day, completely different industry to us, and she was saying that she has two people that she can outsource work to, and one of them is very good but charges her almost as much as she charges the client.
Right, so an emergency case then.
And the other is pretty bad but very cheap.
Oh,
and
no.
So every time she needs to outsource work, she has to decide, do I want to get very little of the money but actually feel confident it's being done well?
Devastating.
Or do I need more of the money but know I'm going to have to go in and fix a lot of the problems, and a lot of outsourcers find themselves in that kind of position. Now, in all the ideas we've mentioned so far, you can use your writing skills, but you might also have other skills that you could leverage for some passive or ongoing income. I mean, I design t-shirts, for example, and I put them for sale on sites where people can order them, and then I get a cut of the cost. So I don't need to do anything once I've uploaded the designs. The site does all the work. And I can do really nicely from it, actually, especially the run-up to Christmas is a big one. And so sites like Cafe Press, Zazzle, Redbubble, I'll link to them all in the show notes. If you've got some decent Photoshop skills and some creative, clever ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing you could perhaps think of. But there are tons of options.
Yeah, this is good for people who are big fans of puns, isn't it? Because you can do anything. It's not just T-shirts. Obviously, you can do cups and mobile phone covers and posters and, you know, artwork. People like prints at the moment, don't they? Sort of over Instagram pictures.
Yeah.
Like inspirational quotes and stuff.
Yeah.
Those can sell quite well on things like society6.com.
Yep, I have some stuff on there. Not much, actually, because it's quite new.
Society6 for creative writing prompts, actually. Go on there.
Yeah.
Inspired.
But, yeah, I make a sale most days for most of the year, and then in the run-up to Christmas, numerous.
Many.
And these are T-shirts I designed several years ago. I do add the odd new one when I've got time.
Yeah.
But again, this is work that's done and dusted a long time ago.
Yeah.
That continues to buy me the odd beer.
Or holiday, as we found out.
Or holiday.
Or holiday.
Or beer on holiday. I also have some photos up on microstock photography websites. The earnings can vary from decent to pretty low. Some people make a full-time living from it. Most people get pocket money from it, really. But if you already have some great quality shots, it's something to try. Some microstock sites also take video clips, so that's something else you could look into if you've got those skills. Now, obviously, T-shirt design and photography are particular skills, but look around if you've got other interests. Could you do some voiceover work? Could you, you know, there's all sorts of...
Etsy. Knit on
Etsy. Oh, I love Etsy.
Yeah, collaging, beading, knitting, crocheting.
Yeah.
Anything really, repurposing stuff, recycling stuff.
Yeah, Folksy is a kind of Etsy equivalent based in the UK as well.
Make sure you're good and you don't end up on Regretsy, which I love looking at sometimes. It's so
fabulous.
Funny. People sell the strangest things. I suppose really we should give a nod to eBay and Amazon at this point.
Yeah.
You know, people that I know go charity shop shopping. So what's that in American?
Thrift shop.
Thrift shopping. And then resell stuff, again, at a commission. If you find something lovely, if you know your antiques, or if you know collectibles, you can go around, have a look. You can sell books, things like that, you know, and people sometimes just make a bit of commission on postage.
Yeah. Or getting charity shop clothes and doing them up, adding a bit of embroidery or shopping them.
Reading, prints, potato prints. Oh, how fun are they?
So, yeah, if you start thinking creatively, there's tons of...
I don't want to be a writer anymore. I just want to print potato things all over everything and sell them.
Follow your bliss, Laurie.
make a fortune. I'm going to be like Richard Branson of potato printing. So hopefully then that has given you a bit of a boost, because we know that business development can be a drag. We know it can be hard trawling the net, looking for clients, thinking I'm never going to get anybody else on board and I need some extra cash. So... hopefully this will just be a bit of a boost, give you some ideas, give you a bit of inspiration, maybe help you see that actually you don't have to pigeonhole yourself, because that's one of the wonderful things about being a freelancer, isn't it? That if you need to nip out in the middle of the day and do an hour in a charity shop and then come home, wash the clothes and sell them on eBay, you can do that. You don't have to stick rigidly to any one thing. You can just be a freelancer who does writing as well.
Yeah, portfolio career, that's the thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, that's such a nice term, I've not heard that.
Ah, yes, it's growing in popularity for people who really do a bit of this and a bit of that.
It's good for new mums and, you know, people who are getting back into work after having children, you know, people who have been made redundant and they're not too sure what they can be doing. It's lovely to just try your hand at a few things, and it's a very modern way of working because we don't have jobs for life much anymore, do we?
No. And if you have any other ways of generating additional income streams, then we want to know.
Yes.
So go to facebook.com/freelancewritingpodcast
do
and
it.
Tell us.
That's it. Tell us, because we've got some noisy people on there, but we would love some more noisy people and some more good ideas. So come and have a chinwag.
And so now it is time for the much-awaited and always loved first recommendations of the week, in which Laurie and I share something we've seen or that's caught our eye that we think might be of interest to our listeners. So, Laurie, what is your recommendation this week?
There was one blog post that I found, and I was surprised, actually, that I found it, and two, that I liked it so much.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in, it's an ad agency in London. It's in their business blog. So normally, you know, I know that I do a lot of blogging for clients, including agency clients, but normally it's the big sites like Copyblogger and Mashable that have the really interesting pieces of writing, but I thought this one was really, really good. And it's called Ding Ding, 9 Knockout Inbound Marketing Tips to Help You Achieve Success. Now, it's a bit of a clunky title, but I like the ding ding, so it caught my attention. And what this looks at are, predictably, 9 ways to boost your inbound marketing. And there's a wee inbound marketing funnel infographic at the bottom, which shows you kind of the path that people take from encountering you online the first time into all the way down to acting on what they've read from you, which is hopefully hiring you or buying what you're telling them to buy.
Yeah.
Now, aside from a really annoying typo in this, which I wonder if people will be able to spot it, I'm not going to mention it. Typos, they get us, don't they?
Oh, every time.
It just has some really good standard tips that I still see a lot of freelance writers not following. They're fairly basic, but they are all really good tips. The first one is keep landing pages simple.
Yeah.
And these are all the kinds of things, because it's inbound marketing, it's all kind of your content, your website, your blog, your videos, your social media feeds. So it's a really good article for doing a bit of housekeeping, I think.
Yeah, checking that your systems are as good as they can be, really.
This is it, you know, because people can be working and working and working and working and working and finding that it's just not working.
Yeah. And you get stuck in a rut, don't you?
Of course you do. So things like this, and I don't exclude myself from this at all.
Oh, no, of course not.
Like this, very handy.
Yeah.
Second point is educate them and they will come. You know, does your content match compliment?
See?
Compliment with an I. Compliment your consumer needs, excuse me. The third is searchable content. Fourth is your blog speaks volumes about you, quote-unquote. And it's nice that they've actually acknowledged that the you on your blog is the point we've made quite often.
Mm.
Doesn't necessarily need to be all of you, so no sangria.
Yeah.
Point six, pushing on. Allow your audience to visualize you. That was a typo that was annoying me. 7, ebooks, white paper reports and webinars. So talking about this authoritative content that we talked about earlier. Infographics have unbelievable value, and then they give you that inbound marketing funnel infographic. And it's really lovely spaced out article. It's on a nice clean background, and I just found it really accessible, really lovely. It's got screenshots to show you what's going on. It's very accessible in terms of language. So I think the one point that we'd kind of finish on with this is that you and I have been freelancing for a while, haven't we?
We certainly have.
And I think sometimes I hear from people, because we get a lot of emails from people who've listened or who've encountered us online asking for information and advice and stuff. And I think sometimes we can forget how little you know when you start out.
Yeah.
You think you know, because you actually do know it. You perhaps just don't know the terms for it.
Yeah.
So something like this is very, very accessible, and it explains things like calls to action, and it explains latent semantic indexing, and, you know, making your content searchable. It uses searchable as a term, and that's lovely because it tells you why you need to be doing these things.
Yeah.
You need to be considering, because people can think, I don't know about SEO, I don't know about optimization, I don't know about that and the other. But really, a lot of it's common sense and just learning on the job, and I think this is a really good article for that.
And presenting it accessibly is, I mean, as Laurie said when she was introducing it, none of it is kind of vastly new information.
No.
But most of the information we read isn't vastly new.
No.
It's, so what makes something good is how it's presented. Is it presented in a way that makes it feel new, or that makes it really easy to understand, and maybe a term that you've been reading about for hours, you suddenly go, oh, I get it now.
I know what that is now.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's great.
No, I thought it was fab. And I thought, because obviously, having freelanced for yonks, I know the information in this article. So the fact that it caught my attention.
Yeah.
That was enough for me to want to recommend it.
Yeah.
So, good. So, Philippa.
Now, I present my recommendation this week with some fierceness because of the earnesty with which I mean it. But don't take that to mean that it's a work of heavity, and don't let that thought cause you any nervosity, because I choose my recommendations with rigorosity. And so, with seriosity, I want to recommend an excellent blog post on mental floss, full of some rather delightful abstract nouns that have somehow fallen out of fashion. And it is our responsibility, little birds, to bring them back into use.
Goodness. Oh, dear me.
That took some rehearsal, I have to say.
I'll bet it did.
I even had to write down pronunciation in brackets afterwards.
I've got tears in my eyes. You got to rigorosity and it just got a bit much. Okay, so let's hear more about your rigorously researched recommendation.
Well, it's just lovely. It's words that we haven't seen for a long time, like for many centuries in some cases, that have been identified as just having something about them. And it makes me want to get involved in some kind of preservation campaign to bring them back because, you know, they're just lovely.
I think some of them, I've just clicked through, looking at them, some of them look quite French.
Yes, indeed.
Romance language based. Latin
debonairity.
That's nice, isn't it?
It is outrageous tea.
Fabulous.
There's so much more outrageous than outrageousness. Too bad it fell out of use after the 15th century.
Gutted. Do you know, this taps into something that I've been having fun with recently. And I think I genuinely think it makes me a bad person. But I have fun sometimes correcting people when they're not wrong and getting them to use really ridiculous nouns that don't exist. So somebody used the word boringness the other day, and I'm pretty sure that's not actually a word. It probably is a word. I'm going to have to look that up. But I got them to use beringitude instead.
Not boredom.
Not boredom, no. beringitude, as in something being boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was wonderful, and they corrected themselves. They were like, oh, sorry, yeah, beringitude.
You have such terribility, Laurie.
I'm dreadful. I'm admitting this with a certain level of nervosity, I have to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the seamlessity of this admission.
But it doesn't show a very high level of graciosity, does it?
And listeners, we could do this for hours. We
probably will after we finish recording this.
The hours we could do it with wouldn't be futy.
For goodness sakes.
It's there. It's number four.
I know. It's just the terribility of it all. Goodness sake. We're like a pair of drunks in a pub.
We found some words.
So silly. It's like when children start learning languages at school and they look up all the swear words. Only I think we're less cool.
Yes, indeed.
Oh dear, I like this recommendation, it's really nice.
So, you know, it won't help you in your work necessarily, but it's enjoyable and, you know, to be honest, if any listeners manage to get one of these words legitimately into their copy.
Oh yeah, screenshot a tiny bit of your piece of work, put a big red ring around it and we will post that thing.
You will get a special mention on our Facebook page.
Absolutely.
And we will
lots
work
of applause.
It then on.
Yeah, no, we'll love you for it.
Do it.
Fabulous.
You can find the link at littlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com.
Just love it.
Just love it.
So, just click it.
All its outrageous G.
Da 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 da. I'm loving it. Beautiful.
And so, thank you so much for listening. Do head over to alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com and subscribe. You know you want to be the first to hear next time we have an episode out, which will be Laurie's solo episode next time.
It will. So do make sure you come along and subscribe. Any questions in the meantime, do come and have a chat with us, facebook.com/freelancewritingpodcast. And you can find all of our details at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com.
And so, thank you very much for listening. I have been Philippa Willett.
And I have been Laurie Hartzell, and we will catch you next time.